Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for listening to 89.1 FM Lakeshore Public Radio, streaming worldwide at lakeshorepublicradio.org. It's time for Midwest Beat with yours truly, Tom Lounges. This program is all about music and the people who make it. The second hour of today's program is going to feature in studio with me, Dave Sanchez of the Sounds of Santana. Dave's supposed to be bringing his guitar in. We'll perform a few tunes live on air, talk about his career, and the Sounds of Santana show happening this Saturday at Bulldog Park in Crown Point. But the first hour, Johnny Iguana is going to join us by phone. Johnny, of course, has been on this program as a member of the Claudettes. Johnny's got a brand new album, his first solo piano blues album, Johnny Iguana's Chicago Spectacular. We'll find out why it's so spectacular after your headlines. Stay with us. Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for supporting public radio here at Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and streaming worldwide at lakeshorepublicradio.org. I'm Tom Lounges, and it's time now for Midwest Beat, a program all about music and the people who make it. As I mentioned on the other side of the news, coming up the second hour, Mr. Dave Sanchez will be live in studio with his guitar. Dave is the lead singer, founding member of Sounds of Santana. Yeah, they're a Santana tribute act, and they've been around a good many years. We'll talk to Dave about the history of the band. He'll play a few tunes live on air. And we'll also find out about the big free concert this Saturday in Crown Point at the outdoor Bulldog Park Pavilion. But first, there's always a first hour, and I've got a very special guest joining us. Johnny Iguana is going to call in just a moment or two, and Johnny's no stranger to this program. We've been playing music from his group, the Claudettes, for a while now. They put an album out a couple of years, maybe 2 years ago? I can't remember. We'll find out. Dance Scandal at the Gymnasium. And that's an album that's been making, hitting the radar charts a lot and getting a lot of fans for this Chicago-based band, the Claudettes. Johnny is the keyboardist and, I believe, founder of that group. We'll find out a little bit about the future for the Claudettes as Johnny starts carving his own solo career out. You see, Johnny just released today, this very day, Johnny Iguana's Chicago Spectacular. It's a solo piano blues album, and it kicks it, boys and girls. We're going to hear some songs from it. We're going to talk to Johnny about it, and we're going to find out exactly why it's so spectacular. I'll give you a hint. It's got some really big names sitting in with them. All right, so let's check it out first, and then we'll get Johnny on the horn. Let the music do the talking, maestro. This is 44 Blues. Watch out. Thank you. Johnny Iguana carrying around that 44. He's got the 44 blues. If you're a backdoor man, you better watch out. He's on the prowl, and he's on the radio with us right now. Johnny Iguana's new album, Chicago Spectacular, released today, this very day. And we are so happy to be here on this monumental day that his first solo piano blues album comes out. Johnny, welcome back to Midwest Beat.
Hey, man. Good to hear you.
Love this album. I really love this album. I was so surprised to see that you were putting this out. I had not heard an inkling of it.
The element of surprise is the most important thing in the music business.
I say it is. And you surprised me. I got the press release and I said, holy cow, Johnny's going solo. So first question before we get into the solo album, what does that mean for the Claudettes? I mean, that group is really starting to hit the radar, as I mentioned. You guys did a great album, 2019, I think it was. And that was the gymnasium album that you did. What's happening with that band?
Oh, well, you know, I think of Nico Case and Nora Jones, people like that, that are 100% of the time in at least two great bands. And I've been that way since I was 15. I mean, I've always had a punk band here and a blues band there. And I kind of feel like it recalibrates me to kind of go and play sort of different things with different groups. And everything seems fresh when you come back to it. And the Claudettes not only put out a record that's, our best, really would go on any record and say that. It came out on April 3rd on 40 Below Records, and Ted Hutt produced that one, and he's produced Violent Femmes and Gaslight Anthem and Mighty Mighty Boss Tones, a lot of great bands, and it's a really special record. But also, I'd been approached by Larry Scholer, who was only produced maybe five records or so, and four of them have had Grammy nominations. And
wow,
that's a really competitive field to get a blues Grammy nomination. There's so many releases and so few categories. You know, it's gone from one to two. I think it was two categories, and then it went to one, and then I think it's back to two again for contemporary and traditional. But when he reached out to me and said he wanted to produce my own blues piano album and do it as like a tribute to the great Chicago blues piano masters of the past, as well as, you know, kind of assert my own compositions and musical voice within the record, I that was just going to be done as soon as he made the suggestion. So we kind of conceived the which tracks we would do to celebrate which piano players, and then who we'd invite to sing and play them, and then we put four instrumentals on there too that are kind of actually reworked Claudette's instrumentals that we did with Bill Dickens on bass. He's Leo Nocentelli's bass player, you know, from the Meters, so you know he's going to be the best.
Oh yeah.
He's just incredibly wicked, groovy bass player. And so I'm really lucky that I'm able to pick up the phone and reach people like Little Ed and Billy Boy Arnold, and Billy Boy calls me pretty often and we talk, and we're always talking about music, and he sends me Sonny Boy Williamson records in the mail. That's really cool. John Primer, Matthew Scholer, and Billy Flynn and Kenny Smith. So, Michael Caskey. So all these guys were able to, I split the days. We did live in the studio sessions, and It really came out even better than I'd hoped when Larry first got a hold of me. So the Claudettes not only released a recent album, but we've been recording during this pandemic, and we're mostly through another one that just wow. don't have any release plans for that. But hey, life is short, and if I've got ideas that I'm excited about, they're getting recorded. You know,
you're making the most of the downtime and the shelter in place situation, aren't you?
Yeah, you know, I'm not particularly cut out for the endless live streaming and the Venmo and the PayPal. Like, I know everyone's got to get by, and some people are more cut out for it and do really good solo performances. And I'm going to be doing some, and it's my own kind of a thing, just kind of solo piano, going completely bananas on the piano the way I like to. And mm-hmm. I think that'll be really fun to watch. But just like the Claudettes, in particular, none of the members are really keen on just, you know, regular live streams. Just none of us are really tech heads anyway in terms of the audio and video quality, and I know it's going to just end up looking like, you know, pixelated and slow Wi-Fi. And,
right.
And maybe at some point I'll get it together and get some of that equipment. I just spent so much on these two records. I don't have money or time to go out and figure out how to become like a sudden, like, you know, AV club. Here.
Speaking of the Claudettes, Mike Caskey, your percussionist drummer in the Claudettes, is on this new solo album. What was his take and what was the whole band's take on you stepping out to do this?
Oh, everyone's completely supportive. I mean, everybody has played in so many bands and different kinds of bands. And Michael is a real blues lover going way back, and he's played it a lot, and he's just really good at it. And we just had a concept that for certain songs here, we wanted Michael to play, and for some of the songs we wanted Kenny Smith to play. And they play very differently. They're both outstanding. Everyone is delighted with as much music that can come out of, you know, all of us as possible. So, and anytime you've got something you're excited about, and if you can manage to get the funds and the time and the people to help you document it and record it, it's just a living record of where you were at that time. I think it's really important.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about the song we just heard, 44 Blues. It's opened up the show today. Tell me why that song was important.
Well, that one, you know, that speaking of the particular piano greats of the past, that one was the one that was dedicated to Memphis Slim. That's the version that Larry kind of pointed to when he thought that would make for a really good piano tune. Everybody, you know, so many artists have done either 44 Blues or a tune that's basically 44 Blues but with a different name. The one that I first knew was Otis Spann and S.P. Leary had a duo recording, and Otis Spann called it S.P. Blues after S.P. Leary, and it was on one of those Chicago Blues, the Chicago the Blues Today compilation.
Mm-hmm.
And those compilations were really influential on me when I was a kid, and the Spann stuff in particular. So that song, under a different name, I knew and have played for a long time, but we kind of followed the Memphis Slim version for this one for guidance, but it still sounds like me. You know, it was really important for me to kind of get with the spirit and appreciate and draw something from all these piano players, but it's not interesting music, I don't think, unless you mostly are yourself. And I think across all of these, there's no imitation. It's not like, I mean, there are people on earth, people in Chicago, all around the country and the world, who are really, really good at imitating particular styles of New Orleans and Chicago piano, and that I've never really, I mean, Spann I went nuts for when I was a teenager, and I kind of listened to and tried to learn how to play like Otis Spann when I was 15 and 16 for just, you know, mm-hmm. hours and hours and hours and hours. But apart from him, you know, I'll listen and again really dig a lot of stuff, but mostly I feel like I listen to it and, you know, sound more and more like me, which I think it's important for any musician to mostly have their own voice. And it's just, I don't think it's a compelling listen if it's something that's already been done by someone else, because
right.
you can't really outdo that.
So you kind of channel your heroes, but you put your own fingerprints on it.
Yeah, especially, a lot of fingerprints on the piano, yeah.
Well, let's play Big Easy Woman. That's a short one. We'll be back with you in a minute. Tell us about this song.
Big Easy Women is the title. I don't want to, you know, offend the other women to say Big Easy Woman. So, But that was a track that was on our the Claudettes album that was called No Hotel on Yellow Dog Records, and that was a duo version as the Claudettes started out as a piano drums duo, and that was one of the ones I chose for this. It's a great piano song. It's really fun to play. It's really tricky. It goes into like quadruple time in the middle. And this piano that I chose, this studio, Shirk Studios, for a couple reasons. Number one is Steve Shirk. He's just a great energy and runs a great studio, and it's a really pleasure to record there. I've recorded there a bunch of times now. But another thing is he has a 100-year-old Chicago-made upright piano in there, and too many studios only have a grand, and a grand piano is great, and I've used them a lot on recordings. But when you're doing what you want to be a real deal blues record, you shouldn't play on a nice, you know, glossy grand. And it doesn't have the right sound or the right action. So this beat up old instrument, actually, the hammer assemblies came undone, and we had to glue them back together at least four times, literally. And the cover of the album, you see my bloody hand. That happened during the recording of the title of Land of Precisely Three Dances. There's a thing called glissandos you do on the piano where you kind of wipe your hand up and down the keys real fast, you know? And when I did that, it didn't make any sound. It just took the skin off my hand. But this is that song redone that you'll hear. There's some real cool kind of like weirdo shrieking in the middle of the tune. It's Bill Dickens' bass pedal. He had an old vintage effects pedal in the bass, and it makes it sound like a theremin. So that's what you're hearing in the middle. It's actually from the bass guitar.
Really? Wow. Cool. I never would have guessed that.
No, I wouldn't have either, but I saw it in my own eyes. I'm like, God. And people thought it was a little controversial in the studio because it's real trippy and out there, but I thought it just only adds to the kind of carnival element of this song.
And I think we've come to expect a little outside the box from you with all your projects.
It's just honesty is all.
Yeah. Well, let's do it. This is Big Easy Women for all of you women out there. And this is a short one, so turn it up and crank it up. This is Johnny Iguana off Chicago Spectacular. More with Johnny on Midwest Beat after this. Big Easy Women, that's Johnny Iguana of the Claudettes going solo there on a piano debut album called Chicago Spectacular. Lots and lots of guests on it. Just look for the album cover in your brick and mortar stores or online of the Bloody Fingers on the 88 Keys and a whole lot of name dropping going on that cover as well. Lots of famous folks on there. Little Ed, John Primer, Billy Boy Arnold. One of my favorites, Steady Rollin' Bob Margolin is on here too.
Yeah.
Muddy Waters, a guitar player for many years. I didn't think he was still playing. Did you coax him out of retirement, or is he still out there doing it?
Oh, he's steady rolling. None of us are playing much right now, but I run into him a bunch of times on the road. As a matter of fact, the Claudettes played in Estonia in late 2018, and we played right before Bob. I was very pleased to see that not only were we on the same day of this great Augusta Blues Festival in Estonia, but we were on the same day and we were on the same stage back to back. So
wow.
we played, and then when he played, he had told me he was going to call me up, and I played half his set with him. And then, you know, we were on that Muddy Waters 100 album. Maybe you remember there was a centenary album for Muddy Waters. We were on that together. And he's had dinner at my house here in Chicago and coming through after a studio session. And then we were set to play a festival out in Trinidad, Colorado this August. It's probably, you know, would have been next week, I think. We were going to play together. The Claudettes were playing and he was playing. We were going to play together again. But as you know, as with the rest of 2020, it's been postponed a year. So,
right. Yeah. When did you actually start recording this? Was this project started pre-COVID? I mean,
oh yeah, this was actually recorded last January, so January 2019. And then we mixed it a little bit later and it just got mastered early this year. But you know, after we finished it, we wanted to, you know, see who was going to put it out, and I was really, really, really excited upon visiting Delmark and talking to Julia and Elvio there, and they really loved the record and wanted to put it out. And you know, some of my most prized possessions are my Delmark records on my shelf. I have a copy of Black Magic from Magic Sam. I have a copy of Hoodoo Man Blues that was signed by Junior, and it says Dear Johnny Iguana, happy birthday. He forgot the R in birthday. It says, happy birthday. I love you, Junior Wells. He signed that to me, you know, when I was about 23. It was, one of the guys in the band was really sweet and got a vinyl copy for my birthday and had Junior sign it for me. And so,
wow.
So having that Delmark stamp on this record is really meaningful for me.
Does it look like this is the first of many of the Johnny Iguana series for Delmark?
I can't predict anything in life. I've given up. So I'm just going to keep on playing and getting better. And, you know, I have been playing a ton of piano during these few months when I would be out driving the van to play piano. I can save the driving time. And so I'm sure as long as I'm feeling good and healthy, and I'll be writing and playing all the time, because it's just, I don't know how to do anything else now.
You mentioned Junior Wells, and for the listeners, you spent a lot of time playing in Junior's band. Now, you're originally from Philadelphia, the home of Philly Soul. How did you get infected with Chicago blues as a young man? And I'm talking young, like preteens and mid-teens, right?
Yeah, well, I was as soon as I had, well, first of all, when I had a fake ID, as we all did around then in Philadelphia, back before holograms, you know, when it was really easy to make them. I was going to clubs and seeing live music all the time when I was well underage, and I wasn't really going there to drink. I was going there to see music, you know, and driving. I was in the suburbs, and I could time it so I can get to the city of Philadelphia in 28 minutes if I took the right routes. And so I'd go and see reggae bands and see, you know, punk bands and stuff in Philadelphia, and started also playing in a blues band when I was 16. And we were kind of heroes in our high school, because a lot of other kids had fake IDs too, or didn't need them to get into certain clubs that we played. So we were wearing suits and ties, and at 17 we were playing, you know, Wilson Pickett, and some of the stuff, you know, the entryway to the blues for a lot of people back then was like the Doors and Allman Brothers and
right.
stuff. So we'd play some of that stuff, and as well as lots of, you know, Muddy and Howlin' Wolf. And we also played, I think, every track on Hoodoo Man Blues, which is why it was really meaningful when I met Junior when I was 23 in New York City at the time, and was able to try out with him, because he was like the only blues artist I was qualified to play with, because my playing was too frantic and fast and busy, but I really knew his music.
Mm-hmm.
So if I had somehow had the chance to try out for like B.B. King's group, I would not have gotten that gig, but I did get it with Junior and moved out to the Midwest. So yeah, I mean, it started listening to, my uncle Steve had sent me Jimmy Smith's Organ Grinder Swing, and Jimmy Smith was from Norristown, PA, which is 20 minutes from where I grew up. And so I was into that Hammond organ stuff, and I learned a lot of those bass lines just listening to what they were doing on the left hand on the organ and playing it on the piano. But he also sent me Junior Wells' Hoodoo Man Blues and some other R&B stuff, and what really took root for me was the Otis Band stuff he sent me. He sent me that great stuff of Otis Band with Fleetwood Mac.
Mm.
I think it's called Bigger Than Colossus, I think is the name of that record. But it's, you know, Peter Green just died, and Peter Green is all over that stuff. And he's so, it's hearing Peter Green's like kind of like stinging guitar with Otis Band singing and playing is just so outstanding. If whoever's listening to this, if you haven't heard that stuff, you got to seek it out. It's really great. And so hearing that Chicago blues stuff, you know, at age 15 was kind of a revelation for me at the time. I mean, it's not, you know, that was in the age of people were listening to like, you know, new wave and synth pop and stuff. And I was into that stuff too, but people deride different kinds of music, country music and pop and blues and punk and metal, but every music is good when it's the good stuff. And the good stuff is sometimes you have to really seek it out.
Right.
But I was excited about that music as much as anything. So that's why it was pretty cool when I was living in New York City and just went out one night and one thing led to another of me meeting Junior himself.
So how did you meet him? Did you just run into him in the club? Is that how it happened? Or
I had seen him in the Ambler Cabaret outside of Philadelphia, and I tried to sit in, but it didn't take. I didn't quite manage to do it. But then I was shooting pool in New York City, and I ran into a guy that turns out to have been his ex-keyboard player, Robert Turner. And Rob Turner said he was hosting Blues Jam that I went to in New York City. And I sat in, and he said, you know, Junior's going to be in town like tomorrow or the day after tomorrow at Manny's Car Wash in Manhattan. So I went with Rob to see him, and he still hadn't hired another keyboard player. And they agreed to let me try out live in Boston and Providence, Rhode Island, which I did, and was really happy that I found myself driving to Chicago the next week.
So two gigs and you got it.
Yeah, I mean...
Wow. You must have been on fire then.
I think they really appreciated my enthusiasm for Junior. There were some factors beyond musicianship that played into it. I was a pretty clean-cut, you know, kid with a lot of enthusiasm, and I think that was appealing since, at the time, to be honest, they were sort of cleaning house and kind of changing some of the members of the band and trying to do away with some people that maybe weren't doing the right thing as far as they're concerned with their personal lives. And you know, they wanted to have a band full of professionals that were going to give their best on stage and not fall victim to a rock and roll lifestyle too much, you know.
I think I kind of had
a good resume as far as they were concerned for they could bet on me in that regard. So
you were going to make it to the gigs.
I wasn't going to disappear between sets one and two, which is actually what happened. When I first met them and there was a chance to sit in, it was because the keyboard player didn't return for set two. He went somewhere else.
I have seen that happen many times at shows. What's the time frame we're talking about here with Junior? Was that the late 90s, the early 2000s?
He died in 98. I was with him 94 to 96.
Okay.
And then I figured I would just be in Chicago for a couple of years when I moved out here, but I ended up playing with a lot of other people too. I got to tour back to the East Coast with Otis Rush and record with Carrie Bell, and then getting to be on the Chicago Blues Living History records with Lurie Bell and John Primer and Carlos Johnson, Matthew Scholar, and just Billy Branch. It's just, you know, I couldn't leave here.
Right.
I've gotten to go play. I've had three tours to Japan. I've played in the Middle East. I've played in Indonesia. You know, many times in Europe and South America. So this is where I am.
I'm thinking with that timetable that we may have crossed paths. I used to DJ and book and promote a blues club here in Northwest Indiana called Bugsy's, and also changed its name to Players. And we had Junior a couple of times right in that time frame. So I'm thinking you might have played there.
I remember one of my first gigs, we got stuck in a blizzard on the way down to Indiana, and the trip should have been not even 3 hours, but I think it took us like 6 hours to get there, and we ended up having to go right to the venue and play like in what we were wearing. You know? I wonder if that was like
that. You never know. The one thing I do remember about Junior is that he was a tough band leader. He didn't like mistakes, at least the shows we did with him. You would see him talk to the band members and say, look, you screwed up on this part, you screwed up on that part, let's get it right next time. And do things like that, almost like a coach. Is that something that was, you know, typical of him?
Well, I'll tell you, During the days, he was my favorite human being in the band. It was just so great to just talk to him, and he had so much charisma. You could tell he was one of the greats just sitting with him at, like, a restaurant. I mean, he just oozed, you know, something special. Like, he was just, like, he was going to be a star, you know. And he was obviously used to those records, and no one sounds like him. He's just, he was as great a singer. He's an underrated singer in addition to what he brought to harmonica. But so he was really a real amazing pleasure and really funny and silly and lovable during the day. Sometimes at night when he'd have some Tanqueray, you know, he would a little bit of Jekyll and Hyde there.
Mm-hmm.
And anyone that played with him will tell you that sometimes, he could lash out. And I still didn't find him, like, mean. I just sort of felt like he just changed a bit, and he would have periods of time where he said the horn players are messing up or the bass players messing up, and sometimes I could hear what he was talking about, and sometimes I felt like he just kind of got it in his head, and I wasn't sure why he was. I was pleased, I'll tell you this, I was pleased that I somehow never got in the crosshairs. He always seemed to like me, and maybe he just felt that I would have been too hurt since I was so sort of young and scared compared to everybody else.
Right.
But one thing that I did learn was how much I had to be on my feet, because when he wanted to give you a solo, he would point at you, and you better start playing immediately. And if there was a lag, you're going to hear about it. He's going to go over, and if you're somehow, like, looking around the room, maybe looking at a girl in the crowd or something like that, and you don't see when he points at you, he's going to come over and humiliate you on the stage.
Well, he did that once with the drummer. I remember he did something wrong, and he stopped the song, looked at the drummer, says, "Do you think you can get it right this time?" And they picked up in the middle of it. I'm like, holy cow, that's brutal. That's why I was asking if that was typical of him, because he just seemed like such a, I don't want to say mean, but he just seemed like such a strict teacher-style band leader.
Well, you know, he came from the, you know, he grew up with Muddy, and I think that Muddy wanted things the way he wanted to, and they both learned to. I remember Junior saying that he learned from a young age that, like, to take the edge off, he would have a drink, but the problem was Junior weighed like 100 pounds and
right.
barely ate any food, so that sometimes that Tanqueray would have an effect, you know. But it was an incredible situation, like a dreamlike situation, to just be not only traveling around in his band and in his van and with all those great musicians and people that were in that group, but also to have it happen during a blues boom in the 90s, where I tell people that, like, when I was 23 playing with this group, as far as I know, shows are sold out. That's what shows are. They're sold out. That's what shows are. They sell out because, you know, everywhere we went was sold out because of Junior's name, but also because people were packing clubs, and particularly blues clubs. So everywhere I went was all, like, autographs and sold out shows. So it was, like, pretty romantic at the time. And, you know, I moved out here to Chicago and promptly went to Australia and New Zealand for a month, and then went to Europe for 35 days. And, and this was, you know, pre-cell phones. So I would, you know, call home with a phone card once a week or something like that, but mostly be out there eating and drinking and playing and, you know, waking up and rubbing my eyes and feeling like, is this real?
pinch me. You know, it always amazed me how the Europeans could appreciate the blues so much more than we have. I think we took it for granted because it's such an inherent music to America. But the guys would play here and they do the Chitlin circuit and the small clubs and the things. And then they go to Europe and they were treated like royalty. Did you experience that dynamic as well, working with Junior? And what about on your own now, working with some of the other guys?
Yeah, I mean, with the Claudettes, we felt that that we should be over there all the time, because the kind of fusion of roots music that we have in our sound is incredibly appreciated over there. And the reaction that we got, you know, suggested that we should be there a lot. And in fact, the Claudettes had just started working with a great European agent when all of this went down, and now all their shows are canceled for so long. I just hope they'll even be able to endure this. But you know, that what you're talking about dates back to, you know, Memphis Slim going over there and Dexter Gordon going over there to live, not just to play, but to live, because, you know, they'd had it with America, you know, in many ways.
Right.
And when you're talking about African-American performers, there's a whole different level there of not just reverence, but acceptance, you know, as a human being, in addition to the lionizing the art. So, but for me, I've always treasured all the meals and hospitality and the wine backstage and the curtain calls and everything about going to Europe. Is just, you know, combining travel like that with music that's meaningful to you is just something that makes you feel really lucky and happy.
Right. Well, let's play another song. If you just joined us, we're talking with Johnny Iguana. Johnny's got a brand new album out called Johnny Iguana's Chicago Spectacular, available today, released today on Delmark Records. And we're going to play a song now. We'll be back with Johnny to talk. Johnny, let's do You're an Old Lady. I love this one.
Yeah, Billy Boy.
Tell us about this.
Oh, well, Billy Boy Arnold had introduced this song to me. I had played it with him in Cognac in this old chateau in a, like a, about 400-year-old basement of this chateau, this kind of stone room down there. And so I had played that with Kenny Smith and Billy Flynn. So I wanted to recreate that with exactly who I just said, Kenny Smith and Billy Flynn. That was the whole band. You know, these vocal tunes on this record, there's no bass. I'm doing the bass on the piano, and that's how we did it then, too. There's a certain sound that gives it a really vintage sound, I think, when it's just the piano holding down the bass. And Billy Boy, you know, at 84 years young, for this recording, he nailed this in two takes. I think you're hearing take two here, and that's the only takes that exist. And I've been told, Matthew Scholar in particular had told me that this style, this Sonny Boy style, which Billy Boy learned in person as a child when he got to take a lesson from Sonny Boy Williamson before he died, you know, Billy Boy is one of the very few of the Chicago blues artists that are alive that hail from Chicago, that didn't come up from the South. And he's a real Chicagoan, and he's always been here. And so he was here when he was a kid, when Sonny Boy was here. So but Matthew was telling me that this style that he plays in harmonica, that really nobody is doing it other than Billy Boy. It's not easy. It's hard, and it's very distinctive. And so what you're hearing here is really like a kind of living history where Billy Boy is doing the Sonny style really convincingly. And so he did these vocals and harp just, you know, in a vocal booth, just boom, nailed it.
Wow. You're an old lady. This is Johnny Iguana. We'll be back with Johnny on the other side. You're listening to Lakeshore Public Radio.
yourself another man, cause you was an old lady. You was a sweet old lady. I get a sweet old lady, baby, and you don't know how to do.
Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. You're listening to National Public Radio right here in Merrillville, Indiana. And that is some great, great, great old school blues sound, but his brand new recording. That's Johnny Iguana and the Chicago Spectacular album. Billy Boy Arnold on there. Wow, what a fun song. My toes were tapping on both feet with that one. That's got to be, so far, my favorite song on the album.
Oh, cool. Yeah, well, and Kenny really, really... You know, he really propels that one from the drum seat there. You can tell that's Kenny.
Now, how did you choose what songs? I mean, you said you were trying to kind of reflect your history and the influences and the things. How did you narrow it down to the songs you did? And how many did you have contenders?
Well, the producer, Larry Scholar, and I, you know, had endless emails just saying, hey, what about this? What about this? And it was really, you know, one thing we started trying to do was, with each new song that we thought would be a good one to do, we wanted to make sure that the original or the best known recording of it featured a different Chicago piano player.
Okay.
So that we could, because we had this idea of having portraits and illustrations inside the packaging with bios of the piano players and make this kind of a definitive Chicago blues piano album. Even though Otis Bang gets two, the rest of them are divided up between original performances with Johnny Jones, with Big Moose Walker, with Sunnyland Slim. Well, the Sunnyland track ended up being an extra track that we're going to release aside from the record, but it's really great. That's one with Little Ed.
Okay.
And then the guy who played with Brunsey was Joshua Altheimer, who is very little is known about him. I think he died in his late 20s, but it's really just, he was known as like the best piano player like in the country at the time, and you know, and there's so little known about him, and there's I think one shadowy photo of him or something. So we just wanted to kind of pick a track per piano player and not have too many repeats, and then we sat there thinking about who would really sing this one really great, and I did have the concept from the beginning, as I'd mentioned, not to have bass guitar on anything but the instrumentals. We had four of my own compositions for instrumentals, and we knew that band was going to be me and Bill Dickens and Michael Caskey, but for the other ones it was going to be either me with primer and drums and John will play, you know, guitar and sing, or Billy Boy or Matthew Scholar on harmonica and singing. So for each song we just kind of went through and then asked the people, and you know, for Little Ed, Elmore James was a natural.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely fits him.
Elmore James was the best. It was the king of slide guitar then, and Ed has long been one of my favorite slide guitar players and singers. I had sat in a little with Ed, but I knew him the least of everybody here. I knew everyone else really well. Billy Flynn I've done tons of touring with, and Kenny Smith and Billy Boy and Matthew. And Michael Caskey, of course, with the Claudettes, but Ed, that was new for Larry and for me, to work with and hang with him, and it was a joy. It was really great. He was just, as you've seen him, he's all smiles.
Right, always smiling, always having a good time, whether he's on stage or off. And have you released this? I've only got the digital because, as I said, it came out today, and I haven't gotten a physical copy yet. Is it available on vinyl? Please tell me it is.
The CDs are going to be sent out pretty much immediately. I think the label has them as of like today or Monday. But vinyl, there will be vinyl because the artist, the graphic artist, Al Brantner, I know he was tasked with doing separate PDFs, you know, for that were sized for vinyl,
okay,
the same artwork and insert. So I'm quite sure vinyl will come out. I think there's going to be a little bit of a lag, but you're right. This album really should be on vinyl, and
yeah,
I can't wait to hear that crackling. When
I want to see it on my shelves in my store. I carry mostly vinyl in my record stores, and people are eating the stuff up, and we have a big blues scene in my Hobart store in particular, and I know this album will probably fly off the shelves, especially when you've got all the names on the front that you have. It's good stuff, but...
You know, it's also got, you know, I think these days, especially a package, hopefully will justify a purchase, being that most people just want to stream or at most download. And in this case, there's this insert with these beautiful portraits and bios of all the piano players, and there's also really extensive Bill Dahl notes inside. Bill Dahl, like, were, you know, really
great writer.
Notes that cover, you know, me and all the players on this record, but also the original records. You know, mm-hmm. So it's a really, really cool package with a lot of, you know, a lot of Chicago blues piano history in it.
Now, two of my favorite old school piano players. One, of course, had roots here in Northwest Indiana. Lived in LaPorte for many years. That was Pine Top Perkins, and then Johnny B. Johnson, Chuck Berry from the Seattle, or not Seattle, the St. Louis scene. Were either of those impacting on you as a piano player?
Well, you know, Pine Top, I saw many times, and when I was 15 or 16, and really got into Otis Spann, it was kind of like Spann or nothing for me. And when he died and Pine Top took over in Muddy's band, I always sort of would almost cross my arms. It's sort of like it's Spann or nothing, which I know is totally unfair. And Pine Top was one of the greats, you know. So I constantly am seeing, because of knowing people like Bob Margolin and stuff that, you know, post on Facebook, I'll constantly see, you know, 70s and 80s and Primer, John Primer as well. I'll see, you know, Muddy like live, you know, obscure clips of performances, and there's Pine Top on all of them, you mm-hmm. know, with Kenny's dad, you know, with Willie Big Eye Smith. So, but Johnny Johnson, yeah, I've played You Never Can Tell, the Chuck Berry song, you know, the C'est La Vie, you know,
right.
The old folks goes to show you never can tell. The Claudettes have played that for years as an instrumental duo. It's kind of like, I'll just go completely bananas on the piano on that one, and that's totally Johnny Johnson. Like, you know, he was credited with being very melodic, kind of like Lafayette Leak, you know, very melodic player, but he was such a virtuoso. I mean, he's just, you know, he'd just make you give up, you know, just the way he could pound on that thing. I saw him at the Old Buddy Guys Legends, and maybe you were there too. He came there, and I was very disappointed, as I was with, when I saw Jimmy McGriff, that they both had fake instruments, that nobody had gotten them like a real piano or a real Hammond. You know, Jimmy McGriff was on a modern keyboard that was like a fake Hammond, and Johnny was on like a digital piano. I was like, I would have rented him a piano if I knew this was happening. Sure, we could have rented one for a couple hundred bucks or something. And like, I want to see Johnny Johnson pounding on an upright piano.
Right. I got to see Pine Top play the upright out here. It was a little tiny bar out here he was hanging at, and he'd come in and sit in with different bands that were playing, and it was always a treat when he'd wander in, and all of a sudden he'd just wander on stage. They'd nod at him, he'd nod at them, he'd sit down, he'd start pounding that piano with them. It was like an unwritten tradition. It was just so cool to see that happen, the new generation, the old generation merging like that without a word spoken until after the song was done. What about the timing? I've got to ask you, the whole COVID thing has really screwed us all up. Now, you guys with the Claudettes released High Times in the Dark in April, as you mentioned. This one comes out now. It's hard to release new product when you can't get out there and tour and promote it properly. Why did you release it now? Why did Del Mar say, we're going to push it through anyway and not hold it back like so many other artists?
Well, people are still... people are still wanting and acquiring new music. So Del Mar is really on top of, you know, the modern landscape of how to propagate, you know, the message that the album exists and is great and is out there. So they're doing all the right things with digital service providers and with PR and radio and all the new old fashioned and the newfangled stuff. As for, you know, it certainly is. The record store of today is the tour van. It's true. And mm-hmm. So it's a drag in both of those cases for me. And, of course, you know, as soon as I started feeling sorry for myself that here I am, like, this is my big year. I'm putting out two records that are really great, special records for me. I'm putting them out twice in the middle of, like, a once-a-century, you know, disaster.
Yeah.
So I feel sorry for myself, but, you know, people go to restaurant school and have their whole dream shattered when they open their first restaurant in the spring of 2020. And there's endless dreams being shattered right now. And we don't even know the half of it yet. That's going to be on the other side of this. We'll get to climb out of the rubble and assess all that. So I also write about music, and I was writing for this music catalog about some metal band from the West Coast who this this really grandiose copy on this sell sheet about their new record was saying how in the early 90s this band was supposed to be the next big thing, really like bludgeoning, heavy metal, dark sound, and they were like all the metal mags and festivals were all over them, but they had bad, some bad luck, bad industry luck, and they broke up. And then now in 2020, spring 2020, 30 years in the making, that band is back with their first album in 30 years, and all the festivals have booked them, and it's like, and I'm like, oh my God, these poor guys, of all the times to pick for their 30 years in the making comeback, it's like April 2020. So, you know, everyone's feeling sorry for everybody right now. I just hope everybody can get through it and stay safe. And I know that when live shows return, I don't think this record here has any kind of shelf life to worry about. I made it my mission to not make it sound like a – I mean, it takes advantage of modern technology, but we went about it in a way to make this be a lasting, deep blues record, and it is. And I'm really glad that we captured all these people at these stages in their lives. I mean, Primer and Billy Boy and everybody. So it's I know it was right to make it, and to delay it and have it just sit there having been recorded and have it come out like a couple of years later just doesn't seem right, you know.
Okay. Was it hard to get any of these guys to guest on this album? And were there any folks that just schedule-wise couldn't do it that you wanted to have on here?
Well, we did that smartly. We recorded like just after New Year's, like it's like January 6th and like through 10th or 4th through 8th or something like that. And I picked a time and where it seemed to me a pretty good odds that it wasn't New Year's Eve, but it was dead of winter in Chicago. I figured that most people would be mostly available unless someone had a wonderful South American sojourn planned, you know. But I know everyone well, and Ed I didn't know as well, but, you know, and so I had to not only reach out to Ed, but also Bruce Iglauer, since he's an Alligator artist. Yeah. I think the time we picked was auspicious, and everybody was psyched to do it. So, and, you know, since I had so many guests, I had to say, hey, you deserve more money than what I'm about to offer you, but this is what I can do because there's all these guests on this, and there was no label there to front any money or anything. I just paid for it myself. So I think it basically people basically sort of did me a favor, and they know me, and they wanted to see me make this record and be a part of it. So, you know.
So was this done before you inked with Delmark to release it then?
Oh, yeah. No, we did it in January, and then I don't think we I even sat down with Delmark until middle of the year.
Okay.
And then we agreed late in the year, and then we started making specific plans early this year, and it did get moved back. It was supposed to come out in May, but we ended up moving it till August 21st today. You know, some people would have, as you suggested, would have just moved it a year or something like that, but I don't think anybody was particularly interested in doing that, and Delmark is really wanting to have a certain amount of releases per year, and the plan was to put that out this year and not have it sit, and so that's what we did.
All right. Is there anything we haven't talked about, Johnny, you'd like to let people know about this album, about the future, Claudette's, anything?
Oh, I mean, you know, I use Facebook a lot to update about that, and, you know, the Claudette's recorded more songs than we needed to for our record, so we're going to be putting out a lyric video and then another song for some songs that I think are as great as anything on that record that we just kind of cut for time. And then we have this an extra little Ed song that was a song that Sunnyland Slim played on the original of. And that's going to come out in a while, too, separate from the album. And it's just as good as anything on the record. I should also say that Philip Michael Scales, he's a young Chicago kind of soul, indie soul, I think is what he'd call his own music. But he was introduced to me by a friend, and he's B.B. King's nephew. And he, for a while, sort of resisted that birthright, but B.B. had told him late in B.B.'s life that he had a gift and he should really, really work hard and choose music, you know, and that meant a lot to him. And so when I met Philip, I said, hey, would you want to do a song on this record? Because I just really like his singing, in particular, a lot. He's a guitar player, too, but in particular his singing. And he was really intrigued. He said, you know, I've been kind of thinking of kind of doing some moving a little bit more toward the blues I've been resisting. So we came up with the idea of him doing this Gil Scott Heron song because Gil Scott Heron was a Chicagoan who called himself a bluesologist. And there's, you know, there's a good amount of blues in his sound. And I just thought that this kind of more like, you know, like, because, you know, we think of Gil Scott Heron as a progenitor of rap, but really a lot of this stuff is really kind of like sort of got a Chicago soul element to it.
Right.
In his own way. And I just knew that he'd be great on it. And he sings so great. The whole track is just me on piano, him on acoustic guitar and singing. And Michael Caskey played some percussion. So he does Lady Day and John Coltrane on there. And people should check that out. And I think there's a good chance that he's going to, when the touring world opens up again, that he's going to come out on tour and be part of the band.
Now, when you do this on vinyl, are you going to release any of those extra tracks as a bonus, like a bonus track? They used to do that with CDs to get people to buy the CD over the vinyl, and I'm starting to see that come back opposite now.
Yeah, you know, that's a good point that if there's assuming, of course, there will be a download card with the vinyl, why not put the extra track on that one?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Because we took it off, you know, a good part of the reason was for space, you know, trying to keep each side of the vinyl under 20 minutes.
Right.
And we just squeaked by with the rest of the tracks that we had. So that one, since we already had two other songs with Ed on it, and that's the third one, we thought, let's make this a bonus track. But, yeah, that's a good idea to keep it as a, you know, exclusive kind of, you get the
right
of the vinyl.
Something else that would be interesting, and I haven't seen anyone do it in decades. I'm trying to think of who... Bobby Rydell, I think it was, that did it. They took the album, and then he had an extra song, and they released it as a 45 vinyl, and they packaged it so the 45 would slide into the front of the package. So you had the full vinyl, and you got the bonus 45 of a completely different song. And I thought, what a unique marketing thing. I'm not even a Bobby Rydell fan, but I bought the album just because of the cool packaging on it.
I've seen that. You know, I write for Collector's Choice Music Catalog, and I've seen recently that I'm trying to remember who it was, but there was an artist just recently that had an album coming out, and they had a bonus, like, red 45 included with it, and I imagine it's the kind of packaging you're talking about.
Yeah.
That is cool, and you know, especially when you have, like, a bonus, what do you call the little plastic piece you put in there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I don't know what those are called. I saw them, but I don't know what they're called.
They call them an adapter.
Okay.
45 adapter. You know, they'll put in a bonus one, and sometimes it's even, like, branded after the artist, you know, the adapter. So
then you'll become collectible on top of everything else.
Yeah, which, again, you know, these days, that's why we did the packaging the way we did with these beautiful portraits and the extensive notes in there, because I think if you're going to spring for a package, you don't want to just open it up and have it be a digipack and no notes and just, you know, maybe ads in there or something like that.
You know,
this has a lot of reason to take pride in having a copy, especially if we do it on vinyl, because, I mean, it's a full-on poster that folds out that has all the great portraits of all the piano.
Wow.
The Chicago pianist and bios at the bottom. So
I am very much looking forward to seeing that. And,
yeah,
you know, back in the day, I used to do annotation and liner notes for a record label, an anthology packaging record label. And to me, a vinyl, you go home, you put your cans on your head, you lay on your bed, and you read the vinyl from front to back, the liner notes, the credits, and it was an experience. And the kids today, God, I sound like my dad, those kids today, they just lost that. They lost the magic, I guess, of experiencing a new artist or new music.
Yeah, that's kind of what has made me sad about the modern era of you know, just streaming, is that is a piece of magic to sit there and read the notes and just look at the artwork and hold it in your hand, and, you know, having it spin on the turntable while you're looking at the sleeve. I always loved reading. Sometimes I think about this Jack McDuff record I have, where the writer just goes through song, track by track, and talks about the musicians and little quotes from Jack and stuff like that. And it's just really, it's just a pleasure. You know, it's a pleasure source.
Right. Well, you got Bill Dahl, you said, that did your notes, right?
Yep.
Well, he's brilliant. He is, and when it comes to the blues, I mean, he is the guy. I remember reading his stuff in The Entertainer, and I mean, he's the best of the best as far as that's concerned. So you've got a great team. You got great players. Obviously, you got great graphics coming. How hard was it to get all of those pieces together, aside from just the recording guys?
Well, between Larry and me, you know, we know we've been doing this a while and know a lot of people, and you know, people are always looking for work. Make no mistake.
Right. especially now.
Especially writers. You know, I mean, you can't get enough writing work, and it's something that you're talking about really prizing. But more and more, especially all you have to do is read Associated Press pieces, and you realize there's not only no proofreaders, but there's not even writers. They say, who knows where this comes from? You know,
right,
so,
right.
So many, there's mistakes in headlines, let alone stories.
Wow. Well, Johnny, thank you so much for joining us. I assume we can follow you at your johnnyiguana.com. Is that the best place for people to find out what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really cool-looking website with a Creature from the Black Lagoon theme for some reason. That's cool, and I'm updating some things on there. But Facebook is, I'm just on Facebook there, Johnny Iguana on Facebook, and that's a little more kind of up to the minute. It's a little more a ticker, you know. And also the Claudettes are on Facebook, and between the Claudettes and myself on Facebook, there's just, you know, and I'm so used to posting about shows and festivals and all that. So as you say, it's a drag to not have that part right now. But these two new albums are making the rounds, and there's lots to, and there's video. I've done a lot of videos for both. We actually premiered a video for this album for Land of Precisely Three Dances, one of those instrumentals. I think is that one you're going to be playing?
Actually, I'm going to do Burning Fire, and
then
we're going to close out with Lady Day and John Coltrane, which you had talked about earlier.
Oh, cool. Yeah, so no, that's cool.
Those are
one of
the
instrumentals we actually made a video for, too. So, and Philip is going to come up. He's living in Nashville now. He was living in Chicago for years, but he's going to come up here, and we're going to do some live in the studio videos, too. So.
Excellent. So the videos will be on your site as well, the Johnny Iguana site?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much, and best of luck, and congratulations on releasing your album today and on Delmark, the label that you were hoping for.
Yeah, thank you so much, and I hope you and Delmark put your heads together and you get a lot of copies, because I think you're right. People will love it down there.
Yeah,
and
I'm going to need
you down there sometime.
I would love to have you come down, do an in-store, do some signings, things like that. We got a beautiful theater right next door to our store, and when we get through this COVID thing, we got a beautiful old movie theater called The Art, and I do shows there, and I'd love to have you. Maybe put you on a double bill with Mojo Morganfield. Joseph Muddy's youngest son. He does shows out here. He's from the area. So,
oh, cool. Yeah. I have a really good piano I bring around with me. It's a keyboard, but it's the best. It's the best piano that you can get that doesn't have actual strings and hammers in it.
Wow.
So I'll bring that down with me.
Cool. We'll be in touch, and I got to get a hold of Delmark, find out who's distributing you, so I can put some orders in right away.
Great, man.
All right. Thank you, Johnny.
This
is Burning Fire. Is there, Johnny, before you leave, is there a story behind this one?
Yeah, well, this is one of those ones. This is one of those tracks that was on that Chicago to Blues Today compilation that Span and S.B. Leary did. So the original is just the two of them. And I just heard in my head, man, Ed would sing this one great. And, you know, there's no guitar in the original, but I was particularly thinking about his really kind of lush voice. And so I thought he's one of the few people that could do it justice. And he wasn't familiar with the tune. He loved it. And I took great pride in seeing some Rosa's live streaming not long after that, where he was now doing that song live. He incorporated it into his set list. And he told me when he was going to sing it with me that he was contemplating singing it two ways, just like himself or twisting his voice a little bit into his sort of imitation of his uncle, J.B. Hutto, who was one of the great Chicago blues greats. And I heard both, and I said, man, that Hutto way sounds really cool. So what you're hearing when you hear Ed sing this is his own tribute to his own uncle, J.B. Hutto, doing his take on Span.
Wow, what a great idea. What a great song. I can't wait to hear it. Let's play it for the listeners. Our guest has been Johnny Iguana. Coming up in just a little while, Dave Sanchez will be joining us live in studio with his guitar. And Johnny, we'll get you down here in studio once we get through this madness. We'll get you to the record store, and we'll get you back on the road to play these songs live. And until then, be safe, my friend.
Right on, man. Thank you.
JohnnyIguana.com is where you'll find him. And this is Burning Fire on Lakeshore Public Radio, Midwest Beat. Stay with us. More Johnny Iguana music and Dave Sanchez coming up. Johnny Iguana, off Johnny Iguana's Chicago Spectacular album, a who's who of great players there. Little Ed on that one, handling the vocals. The thing I like about this album is the styles are so different. It's a broad plethora of styles. It's a variety of seasonings and flavorings, all very much identifiable with Johnny's playing, his style, in tribute to some of the heroes he had, but his fingerprints all over it. And if you look at the album cover, when you get it, because it is officially released today, I don't think the physical copies have hit, but if you look at the internet and you see the cover, his fingers literally are bleeding, as he said in the interview we just had with Johnny. And you gotta love any artist that'll bleed for their art. That's what I gotta say. One of the songs he talked about was Lady Day and John Coltrane, a tribute, of course, to Billie Holiday and the great John Coltrane. And we are still waiting for Dave Sanchez. Just got a call. He is sitting, literally sitting on I-65. And for those that are from the region here know how crazy I-65 can be. So we are hoping he gets here relatively soon. But Dave, bear with us. Enjoy the music of Johnny Iguana. We're going to play a couple here. Lady Day and John Coltrane coming up right now. And if Dave's not here, we've got another great song we can slip in. And we will get to some Santana music either way. I'm just hoping Dave makes it. So, Dave, we're holding on for you, buddy. This is Johnny Iguana and Lady Day and John Coltrane on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
Lady Day.
Philip Michael Scales on that one. Johnny Iguana, Johnny Iguana Chicago Spectacular, out today on Delmark Records. Look up Johnny Iguana, Google his name, and you'll see the great cover with his bleeding fingers on that beat-up old piano, and inside is a plethora of amazing piano blues. Congratulations once again to our guest Johnny Iguana, his debut piano blues album. Of course, he's got plenty of albums out there with different groups, most prominently the Claudettes of Chicago, who is one of Jose, my engineer's favorite bands. And we're going to have to get the Claudettes down here and in group to try to have them when we get through this COVID craziness. All right, as I mentioned, Dave Sanchez working his way slowly down I-65 to US 30 to get here. We're going to play one more short Johnny Iguana song. This is a great cover of Shake Your Moneymaker. And then I'm going to slip in a Santana song, hoping the mojo will help us motor on down and get Dave to us. But this is a final track from Johnny Iguana off the new album, Shake Your Money, Baby. Shake Your Moneymaker.